Shabbos. Well, wait a minute, Mr. Kola.
Yes.
Don't take it personally, counsel, that the courtroom is emptying. We care about your case. All right, our next case is U.S. versus Perez, 082566. Mr. Kola.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. With regard to this matter, Mr. Flavio Perez was convicted of basically filing his false tax returns for the year of 2000 and 2001. In proving its case, the government relied on what's called a net worth meta-analysis in determining his net worth for those two periods of time. We believe there were several errors committed during the course of the trial, basically surrounding that method. The first one is there was a violation of Federal Criminal Procedures Act rules of 43 with regard to his presence in the courtroom. That is our first argument. During the course of the proceedings, there was two parts, once at the end on the 27th, early morning hours of the 28th of February, where there was a discussion concerning jury instructions. Rule 43 says the defendant shall or must be present during all aspects of his trial. There are exceptions. The one notable exception in this case would be in dealing with instructions and legal arguments. We would hold that that exception does not apply in this case, because the reason is this. If the issue on that particular instruction was the wording of the instruction or the case law behind the instruction, then we would agree Mr. Perez did not have an absolute right to be present during those two discussions. But that wasn't the issue in this case. The issue in this case was, should that instruction have been given? And that was an issue that only Mr. Perez could decide. And it was such a paramount decision that it was the government who noted that Mr. Perez was not present in the courtroom. It was they who, in essence, vocalized the objection that Mr. Perez is not in the courtroom.
And I know the court directly said to counsel, you know, you run this by Mr. Perez, make sure you've discussed it with Mr. Perez, that he's aware of that. Is it Mr. Perez's position that trial counsel never conveyed that to him?
You know, it is his position that discussion and the surrounding aspect of the Tolbert case was never presented to him fully. With regard to that, the court did say that.
And when you say it wasn't presented to him fully, what do you mean by that?
It was a discussion prior to that concerning jury instructions in general. Correct, but there was never any issue of that specific instruction. And this whole case is the net worth method analysis in this case. And this court has said in Tolbert and the United States Supreme Court has said in Holland that those kind of cases are tricky cases. It's a confusing area of law that requires delicate hands in handling those kind of cases. In this particular case, the judge did say, I need you to tell it, or something to the effect that you have to tell your client this issue and what his position is. But where the court made the mistake was, it never brought Mr. Perez back out and said, okay, Mr. Perez, this is the discussion we had with your attorney, the government attorney, and myself, and this is the issue that kind of developed and what your position is on it. Our thing is, Rule 43 requires that he be a part of that discussion. And there's a clear error in regard to that in that discussion. He was not present. And the issue that whether or not he waived it or not, he could not have waived it because he wasn't even aware of that. The Gagan case, which is a Supreme Court case where it says a person can waive that by not appearing, where there's a discussion and then the judge says, well, we're going to have a sidebar or we're going to have an in-camera discussion and the defendants wait at their table, that's different. There's a knowing waiver in this case. In this particular case, and I believe the government even concedes in their brief, that when the jury rested on the 27th, Mr. Perez left the courtroom. He wasn't leaving the courtroom to run away or anything. He was just outside of the courtroom. The discussion ensued. And at that point in time, that issue came up. Then the judge continued the jury instruction phase to 7:45 the next morning. But prior to that, he had told the jury, we're going to resume at about 9:30 was the issue. Mr. Perez showed up the following day, and at that time, that jury instruction conference occurred. So Mr. Perez could not have waived anything. He didn't know that discussion even occurred. First, he learned about that discussion or that gathering occurring was during the appellate, while this case was appealing. He never knew that occurred. So the issue is the court should have, at a minimum, said, Mr. Perez, we had this discussion. I want to bring this to your attention. What do you think about that? And that did not occur in this case. Now, we believe that's a substantial violation. It's not a minor violation. It's not where they're going to discuss the legal aspect of that decision. This court has held, and the Supreme Court has held, net worth is a very, very confusing area of the law, and it requires delicate hands. And that goes into our second argument.
And so your point is that Rule 43B3 shouldn't apply because of the difficulty or the complexity of this net worth instruction?
Correct. It was
generally, you know, the rule says defendant isn't entitled to be present when there are discussions of law.
Correct. That's what the rule says. But this is not an area where we're discussing the legal merits of that law or how the wording should be structured. Mr. Perez could not address that issue. He couldn't say, well, Tolbert says this and, you know, there's other cases that says this. But the issue of whether or not that instruction should be given was so paramount. Because in essence, why would the government bring that up to the judge and say, Judge, there's a point here, Mr. Perez is missing? And why would the courts dictate to his counsel, I need you to tell this to your client? That entire conversation would be irrelevant with regard to that issue. The whole point is, should that instruction be given? That is Mr. Perez's decision, but he should be made aware that that discussion is being taken place. The court was concerned about it. The government was concerned about Mr. Perez not being there. And that instruction should be given. This court has repeatedly held that it's reversible error to not give an instruction. Now, we agree Mr. Cotter objected to that instruction being given, but that doesn't take the requirement that that instruction be given. The Holland court says, in essence, it's a confusing area of the law. The Tolbert decision out of this jurisdiction says that instruction must be given. In the Tolbert decision, there was an issue where the judge just forgot or inadvertently did not give that instruction. But we don't say that should go stop there. In this case, that instruction must be given. Otherwise, there's nothing to explain how this net worth method works. And that's the whole government case. That's the whole defense case in this. It's that particular instruction, how it's implicated, the flaws with that instruction. And this court has always held that that instruction is confused. That analysis is confusing. And it held in Tolbert that it had not found any case where a conviction was upheld where that instruction was not given.
Well, usually a net worth instruction is given to prevent the jury from confusing increases in net worth from unreported taxable income.
Correct.
With increases from non-taxable sources of wealth. And here, neither Perez nor the government presented any evidence that non-taxable sources were the reason for Perez's increased wealth.
We got the issue of giving that.
And so my point is, because there was no evidence of a non-taxable source of wealth, there was no risk that the jury would confuse those sources with taxable income.
Well, throughout the proceeding, and this is where the defendant's, Mr. Perez's expert, testified, there's at least 8 points of where the government's analysis was incorrect or wrong.
There was challenge in cross-examination on that, wasn't there?
There definitely was. I'm not saying that there wasn't, but there is areas where there was mistakes occurred throughout this proceeding as far as the analysis done.
As Judge Williams points out, that this was not a cover-up for a drug operation where there's a lot of outside income coming in and being laundered. This was strictly drywalling.
Correct.
And with subcontractors and cash payments and that sort of thing, but all related to that business.
Correct. But as whether or not it's a drug transaction or a drug business or a drywalling business, if a person has $1 million cash illegally in 1999 and he just holds on to it into 2000, 2001, that's an explanation of where all this money occurs.
Maybe he's already got a stash somewhere.
If the cases go on that point where people...
Well, yeah, I think there's some argument if they can get past 6 years, isn't that the statute of limitations?
Statute of limitations is 6 years. And there's a case, I forget the name, where a person went into court and said, I'm a drug dealer. I had all this money from my previous drug transactions 6 years ago, and I just carried it over to this year, which is a permissible argument.
It's no fair now with that change in the money.
Excuse me?
To change the money. Now all the $20 bills, you know, where'd this come from?
I would agree with Court with Gaffel. What the issue is this, is a very confusing area of the law, one that the United States Supreme Court addressed and says, well, you have to handle this carefully. This court addressed that exact same point, that you have to handle these cases carefully. And what we're saying in this case, it wasn't handled carefully. Mr. Perez had an absolute right to be there, to hear this discussion, and make the ultimate call of whether or not should be given. And that instruction should be given. Whether or not his prior counsel wanted it or didn't want it, it's an instruction that's required by the law in this case.
Is this an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
It's a possibility, but with regard to ineffective assistance counsel, as this court is aware, it's procedurally it's not the appropriate form to bring it in, and it is an uphill battle, to put it bluntly.
Right. So it was intentional not to raise that in this case.
Even reviewing the Harris decision from 2005, I looked at that case. And
all right. Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Mr. Podlitzka.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, John Podlitzka for the United States. Mr. Perez, it's a reasonable inference from this record, voluntarily absented himself from the jury instruction conference. This instruction conference took place in open court, and it began as soon as the evidence had been presented, ended, the jury left the courtroom, and the court turned to the lawyers and began to question the lawyers about the objections that had been raised to the government's jury instructions, proposed jury instructions by the defense. There was a written objections that were filed that day with the court, and we had discussed them, and he moved immediately into whether there had been a resolution of the conflict between the parties. The only reason that Mr. Perez wasn't there is because he got up and left. Nobody told him he had to leave. Nobody required that he leave. Nobody insisted that he leave. He simply got up and left. And he didn't go very far, because at the end of the day, when we broke for the jury instruction conference and continued it to the following day, he came back before the judge so that we could take the waiver of his intention not to testify on his own behalf. And the court's comment immediately before proceeding with that waiver was to address the parties and advise them that he would see them at 7:45 the next morning in here, as he put it, in court, which is when the jury instruction conference continued.
And did he say at that point that that was for purposes of continuing the jury instruction conference?
He did not, Your Honor. That's the only remark he made, was to say that that was when he would see you all, is the phrase he used, back here at 7:45 the next morning. The instruction conference had already raised this issue with respect to how whether government's instruction 25 was going to be given. That was the instruction on the net worth and expenditures. And the point that has been raised by the defense that the defendant had the right to be there, absolutely. But our position is, and I think the record really shows it, is that he voluntarily absented himself. Now, he represents to the court conversations that he had with his counsel regarding this instruction and regarding the jury instructions generally. But that doesn't come from anywhere in the record. And counsel says that he's not making an ineffective assistance of counsel argument. There's a time and a place to raise that. If there was some communication here between Mr. Perez and his lawyer that somehow affected these proceedings, that's a matter outside the record. We ask that that not be a consideration in determining whether from this record these proceedings were correctly proceeded correctly.
Well, given that you brought the Talbert decision to the trial court's attention and were aware that failure to give a net worth instruction could require reversal, wouldn't it have been more prudent to request Mr. Perez to give a waiver directly to the court, or ask the court to give a waiver, if not that night before when he waived his right to testify the next day?
That would have been an option, Your Honor, whether that would have been more prudent. The point that the defense is making, that the government is acknowledging that Mr. Perez had the final call on this, is not correct. What we were extending to Mr. Cotter, to his lawyer, was the opportunity to consult with his client before he advised the court of his final decision. That's all that's involved there. The decision as to what jury instructions to request or not request, which ones to oppose, is being made by Mr. Perez's lawyer, not by Mr. Perez. And there's nothing in this record that suggests that Mr. Perez brought something to this issue beyond his own lawyer's ability and knowledge of the circumstances. There's nothing at all in the record to suggest that. In fact, this is the kind of thing that people hire lawyers for, to make these kind of technical determinations as to what should and should not be done. Tolbert involved a case where both sides asked for the instruction to be given, and inadvertently the court didn't give it, and neither side raised it with the court. And the Seventh Circuit saw that as plain error and said that the instruction should have been given. But what was clear there is both sides wanted the jury instructed on that instruction.
And here, Go ahead.
Here, Mr. Cotter had a strategy that he was following throughout this trial, and it was not consistent in his view with giving that instruction. He said that that instruction was going to put a stamp of approval on the way the government had presented its case. It was going to give added heft to the government's case. And that was correct, because we had followed the requirements of that instruction, of course, in presenting our evidence to the jury. So we wanted the jury to see, when the judge read the law in this area and description of how the net worth process should be done in order to be done correctly, the jury would see that that was precisely what the government had done in presenting its evidence. Mr. Cotter's approach was to attack what we had done and to suggest that there were more reliable or accurate ways of doing it. And he raised, during his cross-examination of the revenue agent, Mr. Lexby, he raised with him that this was not the most accurate method or reliable method if you're analyzing a particular or specific item. Agent Lexby testified, if you're looking at specific items, then the most accurate way to proceed would be the specific item method of analysis. That was not done in this case because there was no evidence as to specific entries on the tax return being false. That's why this method was employed. But Mr. Cotter was addressing that issue throughout the case. He was making his points, and his points were, one of the things that the net worth and expenditures method relies upon is the accuracy of the tax return and the tax return preparer's work. And Agent Lexby testified that the assumption had been that those returns were properly prepared. One of the arguments that Mr. Cotter was advancing throughout the case was that the tax preparers were not reliable, that they made mistakes. There was a conceded mistake that was adjusted for in the net worth analysis, and the argument was that if there's one mistake, there may well have been others. So Mr. Cotter was advancing a consistent position, and he reached the conclusion, as the person making the technical decisions as to how to present this case to the jury, that in balancing the positives and the negatives of giving that instruction, it balanced against doing it, and therefore he opposed it. He had an opportunity to consult with his client. He had an opportunity to advise the court if he, in fact, wanted to have that instruction given. So there is, the record does show that Mr. Perez, there was an opportunity for Mr. Perez to have input in this before his lawyer made the final call. There was a sidebar before the judge instructed the jury after the closing arguments. The judge said he would give Mr. Cotter an opportunity to advise him if he wanted the instruction given right before he began giving the instructions. He called the sidebar, so the opportunity was there. There was no request for the instruction, and the instruction wasn't given.
I'm just curious, is this net worth instruction that you tendered, was that part of the Seventh Circuit pattern jury instructions?
No, it was not, Your Honor. There isn't any pattern instruction.
But the instruction that you tendered, has it been approved in other cases?
Yes, it has, Your Honor, and attached, we've made an appendix to the government's brief, and at the end of the instruction is a list of the cases that the government was relying on, both cases in the district court in which the instruction had been given, including a case of Judge Shader's, and then appellate decisions approving the language and the content of that instruction. With respect to the expert, Your Honors, the objection that we made to the question that was proposed and the answer that was stricken is the sum total of what was excluded from the expert's testimony. He went on to testify about what he believed to be flaws or possible flaws in the analysis, and he presented that. The issue about whether this method was the most accurate or reliable, that was where the government objected, because we had no disclosure from the defense as to what the tenor of this testimony from this expert was going to be. We didn't have an opportunity because under Rule 16, they had not requested disclosure of our expert prior to trial, and therefore we didn't have the option of obtaining that from them. That question, though, that had already been covered by the cross-examination of Agent Lexby when he testified for the government. And Agent Lexby had already gone into the fact that that it's a less reliable and less accurate method when you're talking about a specific false item in a tax return. So that there isn't anything in this record to show that this expert for the defense was in any way limited in what he would have testified to had that objection not been made. So there really isn't any impact on the testimony or the evidence that was presented to the jury by the court's ruling. And therefore, we'd ask that that not be a basis for setting aside the conviction in the case. Unless there are any questions, further questions, that would conclude the government's argument.
Thank you, Mr. Podlitzka. How much time does Mr. Cole have? 1 minute, Mr. Cole.
You know, with regard to the discussion that occurred late on the 27th, the court's full statement on that issue was, see you tomorrow about 7:45 here. That's on page 423 of the transcript. There's nothing further discussing anything about a jury instruction. I'll see you tomorrow concerning jury instructions or anything of that nature. It just says, I'll see you tomorrow at 7:45 in here. And then this whole issue of admonishing Mr. Perez concerning his right to testify or not to testify. With regard to the issue of the instruction not being given, again, it was the government who pointed out to Mr. Cotter that it was reversible error to not give that instruction. It's on page 414 of the transcript where the government says, Your Honor, I also went a step further than that. I advise Ms. Carr, there is a case, and I've got it in the back in the folder. I'm going to have to dig it out. It's reversible, Your Honor. It's reversible error not to give it. So the government's making the strongest argument that instruction is mandatory. In the Tolbert decision, this court says, we are thus impelled to the conclusion that the complete lack of any instruction constitutes plain error, which brings the matter within the purview of Rule 52B of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and requires reversal despite the lack of any objection by the defendant to such admission. So the case law is clear. The government made that argument, and we're saying that this case should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Were you appointed?
No.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will be taken under advisement, and we'll call the next case.